and welcome once again to Android Developer Office Hours. I'm your moderator, Joe Mallon. With me today from Android Developer Relations are Rado Meyer, world-famous author, and next to me, Trevor Johns, and also three gentlemen from engineering. From your right to left, we have... Go ahead.
I don't know where we're supposed to start. I'm Chet. I work on the UI Toolkit team on graphics and animation stuff.
And I'm Romain. I also work on the UI Toolkit team on graphics and animations.
And I'm Xavier. I work on the developer tools and SDK.
Thank you. Well, let's get right to it. We have some questions in moderator that we'll start repeating and give you some answers if we can. First one. Using fragments in an application that reorders them visually in portrait and landscape, is there a best policy to avoid java.lang.illegalstate exception, recursive entry to execute pending transaction after multiple rotations in a short interval?
That's a good question, actually. I'm not sure. Do you have me now? No. Okay. honestly, I've never gotten that error, so I'm not quite sure. I think the problem here is, you're probably, just trying to think. I think the important thing would be to make sure that you're not performing fragment transactions right during the rotation. So if there's some way that you could avoid that, I'd probably want to see your code to see what exactly you're doing. Most of the time, this shouldn't happen. So I'm really curious what in your code you're doing. If you happen to be watching live, feel free to hop on the air via our Hangout. And we'd love to talk with you a bit more and figure out what exactly you're doing. But I think without seeing the code, none of us have a good answer off the top of our heads.
Right. I would agree. I think that... based on what everybody has said so far, it's probably best if you do something like post part of your code to Stack Overflow so that we can see what's going on. There may be another reason that this is happening. I wouldn't just offhand assume that the problem is because of change in orientation. So go ahead and post something to Stack Overflow and we'll take a look at it. Let's move on. We have a link here that says launcher icons should use a distinct silhouette. If this is desired, it's very difficult to sell the idea to PMs and designers as long as Google apps use squares with rounded corners. Any plans to change these?
Well, what apps do use rounded corners? Because I can think of only G+. All the standard apps that we ship, like Google Play Store, Gmail, they use... the silhouette icon.
Yep, Maps as well. Google Plus is pretty much the only app I can think of as well that uses the rounded rectangle. And in that case, that's essentially part of their logo. So,
I can comment that this may be that a confusion about what's in the design guide versus what we use. As I remember, the design guide has an example in which there's a sort of three-dimensional aspect to the icon with a dropped shadow. And we're not using that right now. So I would say that you should use something that is distinct, that has a distinct background so that it'll appear correctly regardless of what the device background is. Other than that, we probably have to look more into this.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, the goal should be to try and make your icons match the system icons. I'll also add one other thing. Some device manufacturers do change the default icon themes, so make sure you're actually looking at the icon themes as they're distributed with, the stock version of Android. So a good way to do this is just to go and download the emulator and take a look at what the icons look like there, just so that you're not confused by any of the theming that gets applied by OEM modifications.
That's a good point. Okay, next question. Both Dr. Sandler and the Jelly Bean overview say you can add up to 3 notification actions, but the API overview says you can add up to 2. Which one is correct? Actually, I looked into this just before we started today, and the answer is 3. You can add up to 3 icons with text and intents that will display when you display the notification.
Yeah, I would definitely trust Dr. Sandler because he has a PhD.
Right. Well, I'm not sure that I trust somebody just because they have a PhD, but in addition, Dr. Sandler is the person who actually developed this feature, so I would say that if he's mistaken, we have bigger problems. So, yeah, the answer is 3.
And it sounds like a doc bug we should fix.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that. The API overview is basically something that says, here's what's new in Android 4.1. I don't think we're saying anything about either ICS or Jelly Bean in the API guide itself yet. It happens that I work on that. So I'll go back in and take a look at that as well.
We have a question from Ed Burnett in the Hangout.
Okay, go ahead, Ed.
I think you're muted, Ed.
Maybe
I
muted.
Think I've muted you. Let's try that again.
Sorry, we have
a program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have a program which uses JNI, and it works fine on gingerbread, honeycomb, and ice cream sandwich. But on Jelly Bean, I get an error that I put in the moderator. It says attempt to use stale local reference. And I'd like your advice on how to debug that.
All right. Sorry. So, what are you doing when you get this error? One more time.
I'm making a call to a native function.
Does it occur all the time, or is it only under certain conditions?
It occurs all the time on Jelly Bean.
Only on Jelly Bean. That's interesting. Unfortunately, I don't have too much experience using the NDK myself. Most of the work I do is, is entirely in the Java language. So I'm not sure that I'm probably the best person to ask, and I'm not sure we have any NDK experts with us right now who could actually answer that.
This kind of error looks like what happens when you, because from JNI code, so from native code, you can grab references to the data that lives on the Delve heap. And if you don't do it properly, for instance, if you grab a reference and you don't release it, you might run into that kind of issues. I know that we've had a bunch of applications that were not using JNI properly, so there's this feature you can use a check JNI. I don't know how to enable it. I think it's in developer settings, or maybe there's a command line option. But it definitely sounds like you're trying to access Delve data improperly. Maybe you kept a reference on the native side longer than you should have, but it's hard to say without seeing code or anything like that.
Well, that's what I figured, and I did enable check JNI, but it didn't really give me any extra information.
So if you can pose the question to someone, Stack Overflow or FileBug, I mean, we can route that to the Darvik guys, and they might be able to tell you, if you're doing something wrong or maybe there's a bug. But I know that we have tons of JNI code in the platform, and we have not seen this error. So, and I don't believe we have changed many things with JNI. So, yeah, show us your code, and we'll try to figure it out.
Okay, thank you, Juan. Our next question is, what is the best way to play short in-game sounds? Sound pool crashes on dual-core phones. Media player has 200 millisecond plus delays. OpenSL requires SDK 9 plus. So that leaves audio track. Are there any examples for this API with static sounds?
All right, I can take that one. So first off, a bit of clarification. SoundPool does not crash on all dual core phones. It crashes on a subset of dual core phones which are running Gingerbread. So not all dual core phones running Gingerbread, just some of them. Unfortunately, this is a bug in the way Gingerbread was ported to run on dual core devices. Unfortunately, there's not really a good solution I can recommend. Unfortunately, AudioTrack will, if you actually try and use that, you'll find it has the exact same bug. So the workaround here is really, the best case is to try and encourage your users to upgrade to Ice Cream Sandwich on those devices. I believe specifically this is an issue on Samsung Galaxy S2 devices, and unfortunately, upgrading to Ice Cream Sandwich on those, I'm told, does require updating via USB cable, which also makes it a bit difficult for them to actually update. But you know, if they are on Gingerbread, probably if you do insist on trying to get this to work, pretty much the only option available to you is to write your own mixer as a native library, which admittedly is quite a bit of work. So most likely on those devices, if you don't feel confident or you don't have time to go and do that level of work, would be to go and detect when you're on those specific subset of devices and display a dialog saying, unfortunately, this app is not compatible with your device. Please contact the manufacturer regarding any firmware updates. Unfortunately, that's really the best answer we can give you.
Okay. Now we have another question on the Hangout from Pedro about fragments.
Fire away.
Hello.
Can you hear us?
Are you hearing me? Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Having a little jumps. Okay. So I have an application that has like a dashboard with some buttons that have a lot of information. UI is kind of complicated. He designed the fragment that kept the UI logic and kept it really tight. So each time the application rotates in portrait, it has four buttons. But in landscape, it only presents three for each screen. So each time I rotate, I have to remove the fragments and re-add them. So the problem that I'm having is that if I rotate really quickly from portrait to landscape and all that, portrait, landscape, I have that crash that I told you. Because I read in the documentation that the remove and add a fragment is operation. So I try to execute that pending transaction to be sure that all the pending transactions of adding or removing fragments are done, but the system handles so many in so little time. So I don't know what's the best policy, if you have crossed that problem already there. So any suggestion is welcome.
Okay, do one of you have a good suggestion for how to handle this? No?
Nope.
All right. I think probably we need to go and actually run this by somebody else on our team and have them take a detailed look at your code. If you want to go ahead and just post a code snippet of the code that handles your fragment transaction onto Stack Overflow, and then just post it as a comment on the G+ post, we can go and take a look at that after the show and try and get you an answer. Yeah, unfortunately, nobody here on the set right now knows the answer, but I'm sure we can find one for you.
Okay, thank you.
Yep,
you're welcome. Thank you. Okay, let's go back to moderator, unless we've got other live questions. Nope. Go back to moderator. Is there a way to integrate an app into the new radial menu introduced for Google Now?
Nope.
All right.
Yeah, at least not without modifying the source code for the system. But yeah, as an app developer, no.
Okay. Next question I have is, Jelly Bean boasts that ViewStub is remotable. Does this mean that a non-remotable view can be lazy inflated into this placeholder?
Nope.
Yeah, I mean, to go into a bit more detail, remote views have a bit of restrictions as to what they could do. And so just thinking about this for a second, if you could place a regular view inside of a remotable view stub that's not remotable, you could probably do a lot of things that you shouldn't be able to do inside of a remote view. So just from that standpoint, it doesn't make sense to be able to do that.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Yeah, sorry, that loophole is closed. Next question from moderator. Expandable notifications currently have a fairly large discoverability issue. Is there a way to make it more visible that the notification is expandable? And is there a way to expand it while using the phone one-handed, that is, not using multi-touch?
Actually, don't they auto-expand when they become the top notification? That's part of the discoverability.
Right. So the system does automatically expand them, but the ones that are closed, if you really wanted to go and give somebody a visual cue, you could go and add some small text there saying, you know, drag to expand. I wouldn't recommend doing that because none of the system apps do it, which means your app's going to feel out of place. And generally speaking, you should try and make your apps blend in with the style that's provided by the system apps. So given that none of our apps actually go and provide any additional clues behind, aside from what the notification drawer already does, I wouldn't do anything extra. I'm also not aware of any way to go and manually expand them without using multi-touch, but again, the system will automatically expand them under certain circumstances.
Thank you.
Yeah. And of course, you can always tap on them, too, if you want to actually open them.
Right. Yeah, I would say that probably the best thing is to assume that, in most cases, the user is going to want to tap on the notification and actually go to the application that was responsible for issuing it to begin with. That's what users expect. There's certainly a lot of information now to be gained from looking at notifications in the current releases, but still, we want to encourage you to have your users go back to the application to get more information. That's the best way of handling it with an app, I think. Next question. Regarding bitmap.recycle, recently I have noticed heap memory corruption error occurs. Is it true that in ICS that we should not be calling bitmap.recycle? I saw this entry, but no other documentation, and then there's a link to Stack Overflow.
No, it's not true that you should not call bitmap.recycle. You can call it, but actually as of Honeycomb, so Android 3.0, calling bitmap.recycle will not do much. It will simply set an internal byte array to null on the Dalvik side. So it's going to help a little bit to reclaim the memory faster as soon as the GC can do it. But it's not going to make a big difference. So if you're running into issues because of bitmap.recycle, you can avoid calling it. It's not going to do anything bad to your application, but it's perfectly safe to call it. Now, I don't know why you're running into a crash when calling bitmap.recycle. I'm sure there was some sort of a bug in ICS. And if you have a repro case or if you can file a bug, we'll take a look at it and see what's going on and make sure that it doesn't happen in Jelly Bean or future versions of Android. And I think there was a follow-up to the question asking how you can avoid out-of-memory errors. So what we've done in Android 3.0 is we added a new feature in bitmap factory.options where you can reuse bitmaps. So you already have a bitmap loaded in memory. You can pass it to the bitmap factory so it's reused, so we reuse the allocated memory. And you can pre-allocate your bitmaps ahead of time and reuse them as you go so that you don't need more memory when you're on your app.
Thank you, Roman.
Okay, there's a couple of questions from people in noisy environments on the Hangout, so I'm going to read them out to you.
Please.
So this is from Anuj Goyal, who says, is there a way to add the Google Maps API to the Intel x86 Android emulator? I don't want to build a system image from scratch, as mentioned in the Stack Overflow question.
So you can't really do that yourself anyway. We do plan on doing it at some point. We just haven't had time yet, but it's high on our priority list.
Excellent, thank you. And I have another question from, let me scroll up here, from Mark, who says, on Windows XP, and he apologizes for that knowingly, is it possible to run MTP mode while USB debugging is turned on the Nexus 7 running Android 4.1.1?
Can you repeat the question?
I can repeat the question. Is it possible to run MTP mode?
MTP at the same time as you're doing debugging?
That is correct.
It should work because that's what happens every time I plug in my device on my dev computer.
On XP.
on Windows XP. I don't, do you know about it?
Sure. I've never tried it on XP either, so I know it works on a Mac, but
yeah, it works on the Mac. Yes. Works on Linux, because NTP doesn't work on Linux.
It works on Linux. You just need to install some stuff.
Okay, so it works on Linux, yeah. Works on Mac. Don't know about Windows XP. We should try it. Do we have a Windows XP machine?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We should be able to dig one up somewhere.
Any others? Okay, let's go back to moderator. How can I expand a collapse notification from Jelly Bean in the emulator? Is there a simpler way other than tethering a device to the emulator to send those multi-touch gestures?
No, there's no way right now to emulate multi-touch without that. Two mice won't work on all OS. I think it works on some OSs, but not all of them.
Yeah,
we don't really have a solution for that right now.
Yeah, can you do multi-touch via Monkey?
Guess you could.
Yeah, so you could probably write a script to do it. I can't remember what the exact commands are off the top of my head, but if you take a look at the documentation for Monkey Runner on the Android dev site, you'll see that you can basically send programmed mouse gestures, key events, things like that, and you can use that to go and write a little script that generates your multi-touch events for you.
Okay. Next question. How can one load data on fragments, not creating them, in a view pager when changing pages and avoid destroying the fragments, like lazy loading a fragment's data?
Silence.
We've stumped the panel.
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, there is a lifecycle event that gets called when the fragment becomes visible, right? So you could go and try and do it there, just listen for when your fragment's actually on screen. That's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah. I have a question this time from Trevor Sullivan on the Android Developers stream. He says that he's pretty new to Android development and would like to avoid using Eclipse due to the many quirks it has. Strange, I've never heard that before. Instead, he's learned about IntelliJ. However, version 11 does not have a UI designer. Are there any third-party external tools to help with UI design, preferably free or hobbyist levels?
Not that I know, at least not ones that are really good. IntelliJ 12 will have a UI designer, though. So there is, I think, a preview version of it. I don't know how stable it is, but I think you can download it and try it.
They were showing it at IO.
Yeah, they were showing it, but I don't know if it's completely finished and polished, and it's probably still a bit buggy. And I don't know when it's supposed to be released either.
You can also not use a designer.
And you could also not use a designer, yes.
Yeah, it does do UI preview. So if you're comfortable editing XML, and you should be, because at some level you probably will have to edit some XML. It can at least display what your changes are, even though you can't drag and drop things around.
Okay, any other comments? At an I.O. session, a new version of the support library was discussed that would add a support for the action bar. Is there a general estimate when this will be released?
I can take that one, and the answer is soon. I don't want to get more specific than that, but hopefully sometime in the near future.
Okay. In the I.O. session, and then there's a link, Rado talks about dynamically adjusting periodic transfers and batching transfers. I'm wondering how his examples can be applied to the sync adapter. Like, can I get it to piggyback on a time-sensitive transfer? Rado, you want to answer that one?
Let's see. If I'm very lucky, this camera will be pointing at me. No, let me try again.
Point it at the camera.
Point it at the
camera. Just tell the audience what you look like.
That could work.
Whoa.
Look at that. Nice. Hey, everyone.
Was that fancy?
That was fancy and a lot of work to go to say I don't really have an answer. It's not a good one. I'm not aware of a way that you can piggyback on top of sync adapter. So you can trigger the sync adapter to do a refresh, if I'm not mistaken. So you would probably be wanting to do that at the same time as any other, as a way to bundle those sync adapter updates with any time-sensitive transfers that you want to do within your application. But I'm not sure of a way to do it the other way around, so listen for a sync adapter update and piggyback the rest of your updates that way. Does anyone else have any insight there?
It's kind of, my feeling is that it's kind of at cross purposes to the whole idea of sync adapter, because sync adapter is supposed to control a lot of that stuff for you for things where you don't have something that's really that time sensitive. Sync adapters, in a certain extent, takes over all of the stuff that you'd normally have to write to figure out when to do something, check to see if there's connectivity, etc. And it's for things that you are willing to allow in the background on a periodic basis, but not necessarily immediately. And unfortunately, if you've got something that's really time sensitive, you probably have to step in and do the handling of the transfer yourself.
Quick follow-up as well from Trevor, who says, thank you for the answer. For what it's worth, he's comfortable working with XML, but doesn't necessarily mean that it's fun either.
I totally agree.
He would also like to point out that it would be cool if Google released some sort of UI toolkit to make it easier.
What kind of toolkit is he talking about?
That's a good question. I will ask him and get back to you.
Okay, great. Super. Let's move on. Why doesn't ListView support drag and drop reordering of its items? Can you consider adding support for this in the support library? All the current third-party implementations feel very janky and subpar.
There is currently no plan to add this feature to the support library or in ListView, mostly because it's not a feature that many apps need. We have an implementation in our source tree that you can use. I think it's in the music application. And frankly, it's not high on the list of priority of things that we have to do. Our engineers are pretty busy at the moment.
Okay. All right. Next question. Is it acceptable to wrap SQLite Open Helper as a singleton object as long as the context being used is the application context?
So I think that's probably okay. I definitely wouldn't do it with the activity context because your activity can get destroyed. If you use the application context, though, you're most likely going to be okay. The only thing that you could run into is if somehow the application context becomes invalid, but your process doesn't get destroyed, which shouldn't happen normally, but that can't happen, right? Yeah, so you're probably okay.
All right. Lock canvas call causing a DQ buffer fail error. Got around it by introducing a 20 millisecond sleep on resume coming from home launcher screen. Question, do we need to worry about DQ buffers, or is this just a freak OEM error?
You should never have to worry about DQ buffer. You shouldn't have to know that it's there. You shouldn't need to understand what it does. I would have to look more at your error and your code to understand what's going on. Let's see, it's in surface texture. Yeah, you don't have code in Stack Overflow. Oh, there is code in Stack Overflow. So you're doing that on a surface view, apparently. We have to look at it more in details, but it's not something you should have to worry about normally. It's a bug. There are bugs. Sorry.
Great. Thank you, Roman.
I've got a follow-up from Trevor in response to what kind of toolkit is he after. He says, a toolkit is a UI tool that will generate and or modify the XML. Similar to Visual Studio's XAML designer for WPF/Silverlight applications and Metro UI applications in Win 8.
Well, that's exactly what we have in Eclipse. Of course, you don't like Eclipse, so what we can do for you. Our goal is to make it better and to make it more usable. How we're going to get past people who don't like Eclipse, that's another question, and we don't have anything to say at the moment.
Okay. Does the use of list view provide any benefits, performance, or otherwise over a single column grid view?
There will be slight performance benefits to it because list view has less work to do. And also, ListView is much better at handling things like input fields, focus, items of different types, items of different heights. I mean, grid view really, you should not use grid view if you're doing a single column. That's what list view is for.
All right, good. Excellent. This is a more user land question, but it drives me nuts. All right, I have no clue what I keep doing, but I get a choice intent, drive or Gmail. When I select drive, it goes boom. When I select Gmail, it asks me who to mail and email a bug report to, WTF, which I won't translate.
All right, so that one is, I assume you're on a, doesn't say here, but I assume he's probably using a Galaxy Nexus. But anyway, what you're seeing here most likely is a debug feature that gets activated when you push volume up, volume down, and power all at the same time. And that's equivalent to running ADB bug report, but rather than sending the bug report data off via USB, it creates a file and then sends off a share intent asking what devices would like to receive it, which would likely be Gmail or Drive and possibly anything else you installed that can handle attachments. So, short answer, if it's, don't do that. Don't push volume up, volume down, and power at the same time. If you are using another device, the sequence of keys you have to press does get changed depending on what keys are available on the device, right? Back in Galaxy, or in the Nexus 1 day, I think it might have involved the trackball. I can't remember. That sequence of keys, unfortunately, is a little bit easy to press, so you're not the first one who's asked me that. That being said, if it's harmless, it's just a debug file that gets generated. So if you just hit back, no harm done. If you send it, no harm done. It's just an attachment. Though whoever does receive it will get to see your system logs. You might not want to send it to random strangers.
Right, and it happens to me on a fairly often. It just depends on what your tolerance level is for that. So.
I have a question from Moritz Post on the G+ stream. Okay. He has a question regarding lint. Should lint be able to dish out errors if an application references at Android colon attributes that are introduced after the minimal SDK version?
So lint, I don't think we do any check of that sort at the moment. The issue is that it's perfectly valid to actually reference some attributes that are not higher than your min SDK version. It's just that on lower API level, the application will just ignore them, and application running on a version where that attribute exists, then it will be used. So at least we should probably put a warning, but then if you actually want to do that, we would have to have a better way of ignoring that warning per attributes. But we'll see what we can do. It's a good idea.
Okay, great. Next question. There seems to be a bit of overlap between the upcoming Google Play Services library and Account Manager. Has the latter been, from a practical point of view, deprecated? If not, can you give any insight on the use cases where one should be picked over the other?
Okay. So, Account Manager has not been deprecated. As for the rationale as to why Google Play Services is not using Account Manager, if I remember correctly, there were some features that they wanted to introduce that weren't compatible with the API surface that Account Manager exposes. And so, because of that, they decided to do it as a separate library. As a application developer, if you're creating your own account provider, I would definitely use Account Manager whenever possible. In fact, I think we still will be using Account Manager even internally, just because we have to go and keep track of the Google account you register on your phone. I think Google Play Services just wraps that. As an API consumer, if you're writing your own Android app that just needs to go and access an account, you'll have to look at the API when it's published and determine which one has the features you need. If Account Manager does everything you need to do, then you're fine. If you want to use the new features that get introduced as part of the Google Play services, then, of course, you'll have to use that. It's really just a matter of what it is you want.
Okay. Any other comments?
So I have a question from Chris Hall in the Hangout, who asks, what is the best way to implement landscape to portrait switching?
Rotate your phone?
I'm assuming that, that's an interesting question. because I'm not sure what he's trying to do.
All right, so I'm going to ask Chris if you can give us a little bit more detail as to what you mean by implementing landscape to portrait switching, in that normally this would just happen by default, so I guess we want to know what is the specific use case that you're trying to implement.
While we're doing that, let's move to the next question. It should be pretty easy to answer. I thought I'd mention this. The API reference docs on developer.android.com are pretty much unusable on a tablet or phone. I was wondering if this could be fixed for those of us who are curious about the API stuff as light reading.
So here's the good news. On Jelly Bean, we just tried with the standard browser. It works really well.
Yeah, there is one catch, and that is if you're on a phone. I don't think it's so much a tablet issue, but it's just a screen size issue. If you are on a phone, the viewport's a bit small compared to how the size at which the docs are easily readable. It's a known bug with the docs. In fact, I filed it the moment the docs launched. So it is something that I think we want to go and address. It just didn't make the cut for the first release of the site redesign. So we'll probably get there eventually. In the meantime, sorry about that. I will add also, if somebody feels really adventurous and wants to write a Android API viewer that runs as a native app, I'd totally love you for it. all the docs actually that we publish as part of the developer.android.com site are actually checked into the open source tree. I believe most of them are in frameworks-based docs HTML. So if you really wanted, you could actually go and extract everything there, make your own nice, pretty doc viewer that runs natively. But if nobody gets around to that, we'll eventually fix the HTML site. I'm not even sure fix is the right word. We will improve the site to go and have more of a responsive layout.
It's a great question. I don't personally... I'm a technical writer for Android Developer Relations, and I don't consider reading the API reference necessarily as light reading. But it's an excellent question, and I'll take it back to our team to take a look into more. As far as I know, all the documentation is in frameworks-based docs HTML. Certainly all the API reference docs are there. Yeah. And so if you wanted to write a doclet to handle that, it would be fine. I can't offhand remember where our existing doclet resides. So, unfortunately, I can't remember that, but
the API reference, I think, that's actually generated by DroidDoc, right?
It's generated by DroidDoc, which is a bunch of things that include doclet functionality.
Right. Part of the API references are auto-generated, so watch out for that.
Yeah. You would have to consider the fact that we auto-generate them from the code.
Yep. If you do want to play around with this, just run make offline SDK docs as the target, and that'll run through the whole doc build process, and you can play around with it.
Right. Okay.
Okay. We have a question from, let me see, who was he? From Joram in the Hangout.
Okay.
Yeah, I have that question about Cortex Buster and stuff. I mean, it improves really the overall performance in the system. However, if you want to load images while scrolling, there is still some jank. I actually analyzed it with SysTrace, and it seems that a process called image cache sucks up all the CPU cycles, and the other process blocks on that. So why is that exactly? Is that a bus problem, or it happened only on the Galaxy Nexus?
What is image cache? In what application? Sorry? On what device?
It's a Galaxy Nexus running Jelly Bean stock, and basically some frames get dropped off if you want to try to load an image while scrolling.
Yeah, but in what application?
It happens with all applications, specifically with the Google Plus app, for example.
Well, so, yes, I mean, Google Plus, we know there are a few performance issues in... People are working on it to fix them, but it's just a problem with the app. There's nothing wrong with the system or anything. If the app is blocking, then there's nothing we can do about it.
So But it doesn't matter which app it happens. I mean, it happens on YouTube, in my own apps, on Google Plus. So every time it's trying to load an image in the background thread, then it blocks the rendering thread.
No, it won't unless you are blocking the rendering thread by doing something else or waiting on another thread.
Yeah, I did some a demo with this for Google I/O. If you're loading all of your images, in a background thread, and you're really absolutely sure that you're not doing any heavy lifting as part of your UI thread, at least as far as my eyes could tell, there wasn't any jank. It's possible there's a common pattern being used that. Wow, there's some weird noise on the Hangout. It's possible there's a common pattern developers using that just happens to introduce jank frequently. But as far as I can tell, I haven't noticed anything wrong with the system itself. But then again, it's entirely possible you're seeing something we missed. If you want to, say, record a video or something, and send that to us, we can always take a look at it. But at least as far as our experience has been, we haven't seen this. So I'd love to see some more details as to what you're seeing.
Okay. I posted the SysTrace HTML. And here you can clearly see that the process called image cache sucks up the CPU cycles, and the rendering process doesn't get the CPU cycles. So
yeah,
it might be a scheduling problem at all.
It could be a scheduling problem. It can be many other things. It could be the image cache, whatever that is, because that's not part of the framework. Maybe reading something off the file system, and the rendering thread, for whatever reason, is trying to access the file system as well. So one of them is blocked on the other one. I mean, there can be many, many different reasons.
Okay.
And I don't think there's one explanation for all the issues. But, we in Jelly Bean, we've improved performance throughout the system, but we're still working on that. So we'll definitely look into that. And I know that the G+ guys are looking into those problems already.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I think a key thing here, as far as I can hear, is that this image cache process that he's talking about is not part of the system framework. So it's important to figure out what exactly that is, where it's coming from. Because if it is something that's been installed or running for some reason, that could cause problems in the entire system, although it's not something that comes with the framework.
Okay, we have another Hangout question. This one is from Matthew.
Okay. Hello, Matthew. Matthew, are you muted? Hello? No? Yes?
Yeah, you can unmute yourself.
Wait.
As far as I can tell.
There you go.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had a question on the smart app update. I've been trying to get it to work, see what kind of impact it has on the application size. I just updated the Android manifest, updating the version. It still downloads the full, 3 megs of the app. I'm using the latest Google Play that I can see. It's 3.13.7 of Google Play.
Yeah, so there's no one here from the market team, so I'm not sure any of us are going to know exactly why that might be happening. To my knowledge, the smart updates are just supposed to happen automatically. There's nothing we need to do as a developer to take advantage of that.
Is it going to impact the application sign at all? Because you have a signed file that then they're somewhat pushing bytes into or something.
No, it shouldn't make a difference because the signature will get sent along with it as well, the updated signature.
Okay.
Of course, you don't want to go and change your signing signature between releases.
Right, definitely not.
But if you do that, Google Play won't accept the update anyway.
Right.
Without smart updates, that would get you in trouble. So,
right.
To my knowledge, there's really nothing you have to do to take advantage of it as a developer. It's possible that for some reason it's been temporarily disabled on your phone, or there might be some edge case where it automatically turns itself off. I'm not sure of the details of how that mechanism works. It should just work, though. So. I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Yeah, and it's the mechanism we use for our OTAs. We use the same smart updates when we update the whole system, and the system is signed and works just fine.
Great.
Okay. We have another person on the Hangout.
Wow.
It's very dark where Ismail is, but I'm going to put him on anyway, and hopefully we'll at least be able to hear him.
All right. Hello?
Ismail, when you're ready.
Nope.
Doesn't sound like
very quiet there as well.
Right.
Indeed. All right. Perhaps move on to the next moderator question.
He's been eaten by a monster.
Eaten by a group, clearly.
Yeah. Okay, next question. My developer's console is a bit messy, and I need to take off the unpublished apps. Is there any way to do this?
So it depends on what you mean by unpublished. If the apps have just been uploaded as drafts, and you're doing, you know, say, debugging for, you know, license verification or in-app billing, something like that, then there's a delete button. However, once you publish your application, if you later resend it, if you unpublish your application later after it's been published, there is no longer the option to delete an app, and that's by design. So the reason behind that is because, you know, there could be purchase history associated with the app. The package name gets permanently reserved as well, so if you deleted it, you'd lose the package name. There's a lot of reasons why deleting a previously published APK or a previously published application is not allowed. That being said, there is a UI redesign happening for Google Play for the Dev Console, so hopefully that'll go and help clean clutter up a bit. But right now, there's not much you can do to remove those if they've been published. And if they haven't, you know, check in the details page and you'll find a delete button at the bottom.
Okay, thank you. During this Google I/O, we heard a lot about the use of cards. Is there a standard or best way to try to use these?
I assume this is referring to like the cards in Google Now?
That's the only cards I know of.
Yeah. So inside of Google Now, the cards are provided by the Google Search app, so there's really no way to go and create additional cards. There's no API, for example. Now, if you wanted to go and try and emulate the card UI design pattern within your app, we don't have any published standards on that yet. It's still very new. I'd just try and, you know, take a look at how the app works and emulate it based on what you see there. It's not a pattern we're necessarily recommending to developers yet. If you decide to integrate this into your app, you're on the bleeding edge of things. So.
And if you want to try to use the cards as a user, if you go to Google Now at the bottom, there will be a small button that says Show Sample Cards if there's no cards showing. So you can click on that, and Google Now will just generate a bunch of cards for you so you can get an idea of what they look like and how you can interact with them.
I didn't think about this from a user point of view. Yes, if you are a user, definitely take a look at the sample cards. It'll even tell you some of the ways they get triggered. For example, the flight status gets triggered when you search for a flight. So, you know, little tips like that. Most of the time, I found that they just tend to work properly if you use Google.
Any other comments? Okay. This is also about Google Now. Does Google Now replace the standard search app, and does it search inside third-party search interfaces? What happens when Jelly Bean reaches devices and you press the search button? Will Google Now start?
So in the developer preview of Jelly Bean that we gave out at Google I/O, if you go to the settings in Google Now, you can add additional search sources. So by default, only some of the built-in apps will be used as sources for searches. So there will be like Google Music, Google Play, your list of installed apps. But you can also enable search for other apps. So for instance, you search in Evernote, Kindle, Spotify, that kind of apps. But you have to go enable them yourself.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, even the old quick search box had that same requirement, right? There was a menu buried somewhere that would let you go and toggle which apps were indexed.
Yeah, although I believe that they used to be all enabled by default.
Ah, gotcha.
Okay.
I've got a couple of questions in the Hangout.
Go ahead.
So I'm going to, I think I'm going to read them out, because there seems to be someone playing music aggressively. So I'm trying to sort that out. But in the meantime, Ismail, his question was, let me see if I can find it here. Is it possible to use a USSD code in call intent, for example, hash 122 hash? He's tried to use it in his app, but he gets an error, USSD connection problem, invalid MMI code. Does that mean anything to anyone?
The USSD codes are, you know, carrier-specific codes to go and do things. So they have a very odd format. Now as to why the dialer app isn't accepting them, it sounds like it's either a bug with the dialer, or it's possible that they might need to be encoded in the SIM card somewhere to be recognized as valid, but that seems a little off to me. Without knowing more about the telephony stack, I can't give you a definitive answer there. You could go and search through the source code and see where that error message is being generated. It sounds like something that should work.
Chat?
Nothing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, the telephony stack is definitely all out there as part of Android open source. So, you know, take a look through the source code, see if you can find where that error is generated, and that should give you some clues as to why you're getting the error that you are.
All right. Did we have anything else hanging out there, Radel?
I'm just going to check to see whether Simon does want to ask it, so I'm going to put him on right
Go ahead.
Now. Okay, you're up, Simon.
Hello, Simon.
Hello. just wanted to ask about SSL and certificate authorities across devices. So across telcos, you know, they change. So mostly what happens is everything's cool. We get an SSL connection, and then some devices just give up because they can't handshake. And the pattern I've adopted is to have a number of different landing URLs. And I just fail gracefully until it gets a decent connection. And the one that seems to fail is Komodo, mostly, across devices. So I just wanted to know what the best approach was, or if you guys recommended a CA to actually sign with, the question.
So just to make sure, you're not writing a browser or something that, like that, where you could encounter any certificate. It's actually like accessing an API endpoint, right? So you do control both the application and the server, correct?
Yeah, just making an SSL connection to make sure that, you know, I'm not sending anything in plain. And it works like 99% of the time, but I do all my work with telcos. So eventually one of the telcos releases a device and it's got some... It basically just removes stuff from the CA list before they burn it onto the device. And you're left going, oh, but I don't know, I can't make a connection. So I know I can't avoid it, but it's just a case of you guys recommend just go with VeriSign, or is there a pattern to go with for, you know, establishing or attempting multiple connections? Because the pattern I go with is just multiple endpoints until one works, and then I stick with it until it keeps working.
You probably can't go wrong with VeriSign. If somebody shipped a phone without support for your VeriSign, I suspect a lot of websites would be broken too. Though the same goes for, you know, GoDaddy or Thought or any of the other really big CAs. Now, that being said, we do have an API that'll... this is why I was asking if you controlled both ends. We have an API that'll go and let you register additional CAs within your application. So if you know that there is a preferred certificate you'd like to use, you could use that API call and say, you know, explicitly add this to the trust chain.
Okay. I'll go looking at that. I've been a bit lazy by not looking, to be honest. It's just, I've been looking at the it didn't handshake, so I'll just move on to the next one. But okay, I'll go look.
And then since the app is, you know, I assume it's either preloaded or distributed through Google Play, correct?
Yeah,
just as long as the app's coming from a trusted channel, you should be okay there. The thing you want to make sure that, you know, is, if a user does manage to, you know, if they're sideloading this device, or this app for some reason, hopefully that's not the case, but, you know, since you are registering additional trust routes, if the user gets the app from an untrusted source, you know, an attacker could modify that. So just make sure that however the user is getting the APK is through a trusted source and it's not tampered
with. Yeah, I mean... The other way I did it was to self-sign on both ends and then burn an encoded cert onto the app itself. But it was just too... It wasn't real enough, basically, and it meant that you were permanently in a state of not really trusting the connection.
Well, so, I mean, a self-signed cert, isn't bad as long as the both pairs of that certificate are under your control, right? If you control the client, you can use a self-signed cert, and there's no harm in that. You're subject to the exact same caveat I just mentioned, that you need to make sure that the APK is delivered through a trusted mechanism. So
yeah,
I mean, you're already self-signing the cert used to sign your application. So
well, then I just fall into this kind of crazy political situation with big telecom companies where they just say we got to go via some paid for rather than a bunch of dudes and the devil.
Understandable.
There's a lot of apps up there.
Okay.
Okay. So I don't feel like I'm doing anything wrong then by going through multiple landing URLs to get to a decent sign.
Oh, I mean, you shouldn't have to. The list of trusted CAs shouldn't change that dramatically between releases and between phones. There is a canonical list of trusted CAs that is distributed as part of Android open source, and I'd start with that, and that should give you a list of who we say is the trusted CAs. Of course, there's nothing stopping an OEM from modifying that list. But as long as you're going with the common CAs, if they start taking those out, it's not just going to be your app that fails, it's going to be the entire web.
Yeah, I guess not to keep the whole hangout on edge here, but
right.
Yeah, basically that's been the case. It's just, your banking would stop working when they take some out. But it was basically Komodo got taken out, a couple devices, non-rooted, regular devices that carriers just issued an OTA update over CAs when missing. Anyway, okay, that's great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple of quick questions because we're just about out of time.
Okay, go ahead.
People in the stream and the hangout. So Mario would like to know, will there be more templates for activity creation in the Android developer tools? And will they support the compatibility library in order to develop consistent apps for Android versions prior to ICS?
Yes, definitely. Actually, the current templates do use the compatibility library, but they also use the action bar, so since we don't have support for the action bar yet, I'm looking at you, Trevor.
Yeah!
but as soon as we have that, then we'll definitely use the support library, and we are planning on adding a lot more templates too.
Excellent, thank you. And
okay.
One more question. So this is a follow-up from Chris Hall, who was asking the portrait to landscape question earlier.
Right.
He says he's writing a note-taking app for Jelly Bean, and let's see. People keep typing, it scrolls my things away. And he's trying to figure out the best way to initiate the switch to landscape mode for easier typing. So I think what Chris is trying to do here is manually decide whether the user should be looking at the app in landscape or portrait mode based on his activities sort of interaction model.
Okay, so he basically wants to programmatically switch to landscape.
Yeah, or at least he's trying to figure out if that is indeed the best case scenario, which I would probably hasten to say isn't. If anyone wants to go into more detail?
If I remember correctly, probably the best way to do this... Well, I was going to say you could go and tell Layinflator that you want to put a landscape constraint on there, but then you have issues like the keyboard, things like that. I'm not sure how you actually go and tell the keyboard you want to be in landscape mode.
I don't remember the exact API, but there is a way for the app to request a configuration change. I don't remember exactly where it is. Probably in the configuration class somewhere, but you can... Actually, a lot of games do that. They request the landscape orientation. Now, it might be a little confusing for the user because you're holding your device in portrait and suddenly the UI goes in landscape. If the user wants to go in landscape, they can just turn the device, which they will have to do anyway if you do it for them. But if they want to stay in portrait, then they can't. So I think you should let the user decide what they want, and it's less work for you. So that's probably the best solution.
Yeah, like you said, there are several apps out there which do this. Games, Netflix does it. But an example of just compare Netflix and YouTube, right? YouTube, if you're in portrait mode, it finds a way to play the video in portrait, and I think that's a good model to follow whenever possible.
Right. I'm familiar with several note-taking apps that are currently available for Android, and none of them force you to go into a portrait or landscape. You might find that in portrait it's much more difficult to write your notes, but certainly if you choose to do that, it's easier than if the application forces you to go one way or the other.
And look what happened with the launcher on Nexus 7. It's always in portrait, and so the number one feature request we get is, can we get the launcher to go in landscape as well. So I think users don't really like it when you choose the orientation for them.
Yep. Okay. I think we have unfortunately run out of time. I'm really happy that we got so much participation live from our Hangout. Thank you very much. I hope people will stop in again next week. And until then, we'll all say goodbye.
All right. See everyone.